Welcome to mobile learning, applications that change distraction to discussion. So hopefully you guys that are here, that's what you're here for. It's what I'm here for. In fact, I'm actually a vendor. I won't promo my name or the company name or anything, but to make sure that I got to this session, I actually volunteered to convene. So that's one way I got to a few sessions. I volunteered to help out a little bit. So I'd like to introduce Kyle Bowen here. Kyle Bowen is the Director of Informatics at Purdue University, where he leads a development group focused on creating innovative applications within teaching, learning, and research. Kyle recently led the development of HotSeat, a new social networking powered tool that enables students to collaborate via Twitter or Facebook, both inside and outside the classroom. Another thing that Kyle wanted me to mention is make sure you don't take this session too seriously. It's supposed to be lighthearted, so don't get offended if it doesn't seem to meet some of your expectations. Just take it in stride and turn the time over to you, Kyle.
Thank you very much, Brett. Can you hear me okay back there, by the way? Good. All right. My name is Kyle Bowen. I'm Director of Informatics at Purdue University. For those of you who don't know me very well yet, I'm a pretty warm and fuzzy guy. So if you have any questions today, please feel free to yell those on out, although you may need to go over to the microphone here to make sure everyone can hear me, in addition to those folks who are listening to the session online. You know, I'm very excited to be here this afternoon. I really love this conference, although unfortunately I have to start off with a bit of bad news. And I'm really sorry to do this, but I think it's been coming for a long time, and hopefully this doesn't come as a shock to anyone. But unfortunately, I think that conversation is dead, right? Don't blame me. I didn't kill it. But could you really, I mean, can we be surprised that it's dead? I mean, look at what it's up against, right? It's faced with an onslaught of new technology. Mobile apps, smartphones, text messaging, social media, these are the four horsemen of the conversation apocalypse, right? This is what we're faced with. It changes how we interact with people. Conversation simply lacks the features of all of its competitors, right? If I'm having a conversation with somebody, we're talking, my options are pretty limited, right, in terms of what I can do. I can't really share a conversation. I can't like it. I can't post it on a wall. I can't put it in a circle. I can check in from a conversation, but I won't be getting any badges for it. Nobody ever became mayor of a conversation. I can't really save a conversation for later, not without being creepy about it anyway. And I can't really search for a conversation, although I'm sure it's not due to Google's lack of trying. But you see, the real problem with conversation, the real death punch, was the conversation is no longer mobile. Well, how can that be? The cell phone was intended to enable conversation anywhere. It was supposed to bring balance to conversation, not destroy it. How can that be? Well, let's talk about one example, one very popular example, the iPhone, or maybe more appropriately written, iPhone, right? Now, the next time you have a few minutes to kill, go to the Apple website. Oh, no. Technical issue here. I'm sure the guys in the back are scurrying. All right. Now, the next time you have a moment to kill, try going to the Apple website and finding information about the calling feature on the iPhone. You'll find it. It's there. You'll have to dig a little bit to get to it. But when you do, you'll come across this page. And I absolutely love what this page says. With all that it does, it's easy to forget it's actually a phone, right? I mean, other than the fact it's called an iPhone, I see where that's going, right? That's just it. Is at this point, when we look at our cell phones, we're lucky that our cell phones still have phones on them, right? The phone feature of our phone has become like car insurance. Anyone who owns a car has car insurance. is something you pay a lot of money for, and you hope you never have to use it. And when the time comes that you actually need it, you'd be willing to pay more not to have to, right? And that's what calling has become. We pay for text messaging. We actually pay more so that we don't have to actually call and talk to somebody. This is where conversation has been forever changed. We now use our mobile tools as a way to actively avoid conversation, right? There are a lot of ways that happens. I bet all of us know somebody, friend, family member, or maybe I'm talking about you, where if you texted them right now, they'd text you right back, right? But if you called them on the phone, they'd never answer, right? And if you left a voicemail, what would they do? They'd text you back, right? Some 55% of people, based on a Pew study, said, I prefer text messaging when talking to somebody or when communicating with my phone. What does that say to a person? Right? You're supposed to be friends, right? I gave you my number, but it didn't mean I wanted you to actually call me, right? We're friends, but I don't find you more than 140 characters interesting, you know, something like that. But sometimes you're in that situation where you really have no choice. You're in that face-to-face scenario. Maybe you find yourself in Target or walking down the street, and you see that person that you went to high school with that you didn't necessarily want to talk to then, and you certainly don't want to talk to them now, but you've already made eye contact, so what else can you do? You're trapped. Not anymore. I've got my phone, so I can pull it out of my pocket and pretend I just got a phone call. It's the Pentagon or something. I don't know. And so now you can just walk past the person, give them the old reverse nod, hey, how you doing, see you at the reunion, and keep walking, right? I mean, I'm on the phone here. I dialed numbers and stuff. This is very complex. In reality, some 13% of people will fake a phone call, right? Wow. That says two things to me. One, clearly people lie on surveys because it's got to be more than that. And the other one is, who are they kidding? Based on my previous point, who makes phone calls anymore? Right? And the last thing we do that's just really weird is that we text people who are sitting in the same room with us. This is a quote that comes from a focus group study that Pew did with some teenage girls talking about texting people that are in the same room with you. Now, I'm guessing during this conference you've probably done that once. Right? You've maybe even done it while I've been talking. It probably wasn't to ask the person sitting behind you to scratch an itch you can't reach, right? But in this case, you have two girls, two guys on a double date, and half of them are texting about the other half, and the other half know they're doing it, right? This really interesting kind of bizarre combination. But that's the reality of things, is that mobile devices have changed how we interact. We no longer have idle conversation. Right? We are now informed people having conversation. You know, it used to be when I was in college, we'd sit in a coffee house with some friends, and I say coffee house, it was really a bar, but I want to look better than that. And so, a song would come on, and we'd be like, oh, you know, and we'd have an argument for an hour over who that artist was. But now you just pull out Shazam, and in 15 seconds, you know the name. It buries every barroom, coffee house debate you ever had on some meaningless fact, right? But that's the reality. Things have changed, right? Consumerization is a big driver of that, right? And as people in higher education that work in IT, this defies how we've worked for a long time. You know, historically, we have built Jurassic Park. We erected infrastructure. We put up walls to help people keep people safe. If you recall in Jurassic Park, all the animals were female because they denied them a chromosome. And in many ways, what we do is we keep our constituents safe by denying them choice. We do very much the same way, but like Discovery, or like in Jurassic Park, life finds a way. Life finds a way dangerously if necessary. And that's what we have now. That forces consumerization, right? Students self-selecting the technology they bring with them, right? And they bring it into the classroom. They have their phones, they have their tablets, they have their laptops, whatever you want to look at, they're bringing it with them. And they're also bringing their own bandwidth too, right? So this is a compelling force. And it requires us to look differently at the basics. We can't necessarily be managers of technology, but we have to kind of think entrepreneurially about how do we take advantage of this stuff and accept the risk that it brings. And then we kind of create this culture that's excited by the innovation or the idea that we can do things differently. Right? And one of the ways that I think that it's important to do that is to begin to make smaller bets. Begin to make smaller bets on more than one technology, especially in the learning space. You see, oftentimes we find ourselves locked into a certain technology because we remember how much effort and work it took to put it in place in the first place. We set about to build the pyramids, and we did it. Right? And we look at those projects as though they're our children. We want to see them be successful, and we care and feed them over time. But the problem is that's just too much emotional investment. The technology evolves, and we have to evolve with it. So what I propose is that we start looking at our projects like they're goldfish. We're glad to have the company, but you know what? At the end of the day, if it doesn't work out, I can always get another one. Right? We have to be prepared to turn things off. The other part of it is we have to move more quickly. Institutions tend to turn like large ships. They make wide, lumbering turns. Well, if we can stay agile and be where the ship's going to be, then we can deal with, or we can identify what issues are going to be there before the institution gets there. And we have the ability to do that. This is the first time since the creation of the internet that IT was positioned in the right place at the right time. That we could take advantage of the new technology mobility brings and the new opportunities and be able to lay a path before everyone gets there. And really be able to use that strategically at our institutions to try and support the core mission. In many cases, it's teaching, learning, and research. But to do that, we have to think differently. Not only do we have to think about smaller projects, but we have to simplify. We have to cut corners. We have to look at it in a different way. Right? Thanks to things like YouTube or flip cameras or whatnot, we are now engaged in kind of a good enough generation. The expectations have come down in terms of what the experience is or in the actual quality, but the expectation is that it work. It can be simple, but it has to work. The best example of this is the escalator. I think this is one of the greatest inventions ever. Because an escalator can never break down. It can only ever become stairs, right? The technology has to work the same way. We implement solutions that are simple and easy to use. So to do that, we have our big opportunity here is with mobility, right? Because mobile devices bring us new functionality we've not had before. We can create on location. We are location aware in itself. We can communicate in real time or near real time, and we can connect with resources and people, right? These are things we've not had before. And so the question becomes, how do we take advantage of this? Now, our focus at Purdue has been to focus on a collection of tools, not a singular approach to solving this problem, but to identify where can we provide a broad collection of very focused tools to try and deliver in each one of these spaces. Today I'm going to focus on two particular tools. One of them is called Mixable. And Mixable is a tool we developed at Purdue that really focused on how do we enable students to share and to share anywhere. And by anywhere, I don't necessarily just mean location. Look, anywhere can also mean in terms of the context of the rest of your life. Right? So with Mixable, what it does is it provides both mobile app and social functionality to enable students to have conversation anywhere, share media from anywhere, take their photos or take pictures and share them with other students inside of their classes. And it all does this in the environments that are most common to them. So it delivers it as both a mobile app on iPhone and Android, but then it also gets delivered back through a Facebook application if they choose. And the other thing it does is it doesn't seek to replicate functionality that exists in other places. What it does is it takes advantage of the functionality that they're already using. So, for example, when files get shared within Mixable, those files are being saved within Dropbox. And the students have them inside of their own Dropbox accounts. So when the day comes that they leave that class or graduate from the institution, they've taken those files with them, the files that they shared or the files that were shared with them that they wanted to keep. It also doesn't create the notion of friends or buddies or anything like that. You have friends. They're already in Facebook. Use those. We don't need to build new ones for you. But what we can do is take advantage of the friends you already have and offer you ways to expand your support network. So that's why I say it's really designed to be wherever they're at. And that can be physically or virtually. Another tool I want to talk to you about today, and actually I'm hoping... There we go. So we're actually going to try a live demo on this one. So is Hotseat. What Hotseat's designed to do is enable a back channel of conversation in near real time in the classroom, right? So if you have large enrollment classes, whereas it may be difficult to actually engage in a meaningful discussion, maybe a room similarly to this one. And how it works is that it's accessible from a number of different places. So there's there's an iPhone app, there's the mobile web component, there's an online piece. Students can also use their Twitter accounts to tweet their questions or ideas into the system, or you can text message in. And they all get aggregated into a singular view. In terms of its application, it's pretty simple. The instructor poses a question or a topic. The students then submit, whether that be a question, or it could be their ideas on whatever the topic might be. From there, it gets aggregated into a feed, so there's a unified view that everyone sees, and then they get voted up, and so that you can begin to see the questions asked by other people. So this gets into kind of the fundamental differences between polling and back channels, right? That we're actually engaging or enabling a discussion that happens two ways, so that students can connect peer-to-peer. So if you'd like, I know a number of you have iPads and laptops and mobile devices. So actually, we can do a live demo here. And what we can do then, if you want, you can go to prude.edu/hotseat/open. And this is also available for anyone listening online. And if you can go there and you can log in with your Google, Yahoo, or AOL accounts. Or if all you have is just a regular phone, a regular feature phone or something like that, you can also text EDU11 to that phone number. And with whatever questions you might have. And then what will happen is towards the end of the thing, I'll pull up Hotseat and we'll kind of sift through some of those questions as part of the Q&A. I'm just going to pause there for just 1 second while people kind of play with that. What's that? I've had mixed luck with those. So the question was, where's the QR code? And I've had mixed luck with those as parts of slides. And so that's where we just kind of went with this. That's a good question, though. All right, I'm going to move on. And if you're trying to get the phone number, it'll be on the next slide. So a big part of what I want to focus on today is kind of what does that evolutionary cycle look like in terms of the development of an app, right? Or as we tend to approach these problems. Like I said, a big part of what my team does is that we try and identify common instructional challenges. But part of that is that you can't necessarily go to an instructor and say, what are your problems? Tell me what they are. Right? Because they don't necessarily are able to embody them in a way that you can just kind of latch onto and say, yeah, I have the solution for that. Right? So this is kind of the evolutionary process that we follow. I'm not to say that this is the only one. This is just the one that we use. And it wasn't something that we came to right away, right? This is kind of the lessons that it took us 2 years to learn. And because we placed some wrong bets early on, and we learned from that, and like I said, we've made those improvements, and hopefully you can benefit from some of that. So the first thing I want to talk about is the story. Every technology begins and ends with a story, right? So what we tend to do is take a concept and develop it into what we call a theme. And a theme, and sometimes we have one, sometimes we have three or four, but generally they're ideas, this kind of vision of the future. So that's why I kind of like this. This is a popular mechanics magazine from the 1950s where they thought we'd all be skiing behind helicopters, right? So sometimes the ideas are kind of just that absurd, right? It's just some vision of the future that we think that, okay, we can enable this in some way. Right? This seems kind of crazy, but at the same time, there's nothing technically about skiing behind a helicopter that we couldn't accomplish. It's a bad idea, right? Well, this is the same kind of idea. As we deal with our instructors, this is not their domain of expertise. Well, not always anyway, right? So many times if we can help them along and give them these stories and say, what do you think about this, they can react to that, They can say, oh, there are aspects of that that make sense to me, or that makes no sense to me at all. I have no use for that. And that's fine. We've invested nothing in it other than to write a short paragraph. It also gives us something to discuss with our faculty. So as we're trying to ferret out what their ideas are, many times we can deliver to them a theme or an idea. And that's a big part of that initial story that gets created. Like I said, the process starts and ends with the creation of a story. The next evolution, or the next step in this process, is the adoption period. Right? So what we have to do, we have the story, and the story kind of gets adopted by multiple faculty, and usually that's what we look for, are multiple faculty who have the same common instructional need that exist in different disciplines. Right? So in one case, we had faculty in criminal forensics and faculty in American Sign Language, and they both had the same instructional need. Right? You don't get too much further apart than that. Right? So that's kind of what we look for. But part of it is that when we start dealing with faculty, you kind of look at your standard technology adoption curve. Now I've kind of simplified it a little bit. But essentially, you have your early adopters on one end, your laggards on the other. Now, part of us, we tend to look at that and say, well, you know, there are challenges with going with the laggards because that's, you know, they're slow to adopt, but then there are also challenges with going with the early adopters, because that's usually the crowd we look to when we're trying to do something new. On the laggards end, my colleague Kevin, I guess what I would say is so sometimes your adoption curve, you know, tends to look more inverted, right, in terms of your early adopters and your laggards. But in reality, it's more closer to this. Now, my colleague Kevin O'Shea, he has this term, faculty against virtually everything. So these are the laggard end. Now, we don't have any of these at Purdue, but I hear they're out there. But that's just it. Is that the idea, or the other part of that is could be faculty against everything virtual is another way to look at it. But these are the laggards, right? But the thing is that they're not to be cast off. This is actually a group to engage at some point in that process. A good, healthy level of skepticism is very difficult to find, right? Somebody who will actually point out what's going on, because really, you're creating the technology, you want it to be successful, the last thing you want to hear is somebody who doesn't like it. But in reality, that tough love is the best thing you need, right? Is somebody who will tell you that that's a bad idea, or here's what the problems are. They can raise those specters for you. Now, on the early adopter side, we have another term for that, and these are the Stepford Fives, or the faculty into virtually everything. And we call them the Stepford Fives because they have an almost robotic acceptance of whatever the technology might be, right? Now, these are the ones that we tend to look for early on, but what we've found is that, as another colleague says, everyone knows who the early adopters are, and everyone knows who the early adopters are, right? That's the problem, is that the early adopters are always seen as early adopters. They don't have that healthy level of skepticism. You can get them to try things early on, but they're not always going to give you the valuable feedback that you need. So that's a trap that we tend to fall into, because they're the easiest ones to get to understand these ideas. When we first started implementing Hot Seat, actually the two faculty we started with were ones who were looking to ban technology in their classroom entirely, right? They were just wanting to get rid of it. And what we said is, well, before you do that, what if it had value? What if we could get it to do something else, right? And that's where we convinced them to actually, well, I shouldn't even say convince them. That's where they had interest in looking in other directions, right? And they had that healthy, like I said, healthy level of skepticism about how it would work. So those are the ones to look for. Now, once you get through that process, you have the idea or the concept, that story. You have your faculty now who are really kind of interested in it. That's where you start to head into development, right? Now, the key issue in development right now from a technology standpoint is this notion of native versus neutral, right? This is the idea of, do you develop a native app? So do I develop an app for the iPhone? Do I develop an app for my Android device or whatever platform, or do I go neutral? I go to the mobile web, and then I can develop for the mobile web, and then anything that has a good web browser, then that'll just work. So we struggled with this. At first, we kind of made a decision, you know what, our strategy is going to be go to the mobile web, right? We'll develop all of our apps that way. It's available on the greatest range of devices. But we quickly ran into challenges with that. We started to see some anecdotal feedback that suggested to us that wasn't really what they were looking for. Many times when you were providing a service via the web or via a browser on a phone, they didn't necessarily think about that as a mobile app. They didn't think about that as a mobile experience. They didn't even think about the fact that, oh, I could do that on my cell phone. Right? So part of that behavior or part of the thing you were trying to enable, really we weren't connecting on with some students. So that's where we kicked off a study. We said, okay, let's take a look at this and actually find out how students look at mobile apps when compared to apps that are delivered via the browsers on their phones. So we conducted a study of a little over 1,000 students who are smartphone owners. And we learned a lot. The first thing we learned was that 70% of the students thought that apps, mobile apps, native apps, were easier to use than the same thing delivered via their browser. Right, 70%. Another 70% said they were faster. Using the mobile app is faster than using the app via the browser on my phone. Right, so here we were seeing just their perception of using the app was different. They tended to lean more towards the native experience. The next thing we learned was that when looking at the mobile web, 25% when using the browser on the phone would prefer the regular website over one specifically designed for their phone. Right? So that's a quarter of your demographic that would just rather not use the thing that you spend all the time fitting it to their phone for. Whereas another quarter just had no opinion on it at all, no preference, right? I'll use either one, doesn't really matter. So that's getting at that, you know, okay, so we're providing a web app on the phone, and yet the preference is towards, well, I would have this expectation that it'd be faster if it were an actual app, or it would be easier if it were an actual app. And, well, even if you design it for my phone, there's a certain percentage that says, well, I just don't even care about that then, right? So this was actually really telling to us. And then the other part is that people are always interested in this piece. So what's the actual breakdown? So 84% of the 1,000 students we studied were on iPhone or Android, right? Android edging out iPhone by about 5%, right? So generally, they were focused on these areas. So what that said to us was that we could take a native approach. We could take a native approach, and we'd be hitting 84% of our audience and giving them the things that they preferred. Because also in our study, what we found was that in every category except one, the predominance of students preferred the native app. When given the choice between a native app and using the browser on the phone, they preferred the native app. And the only one where it wasn't there broke even, and that was doing an internet search, right? And so what we studied was not only, you know, what types or genres of apps do you look at in terms of, you know, games or shopping or news or these kinds of things, but then we talked about very specific activities that a student might do. For example, you know, checking your course schedule. But others were asking your instructor a question or accessing your course notes or taking a quiz. You know, we had a wide variety of elements that we looked at, both in teaching and learning and just kind of broader genres. And in every category but one, the clear preference was towards the native experience. So that raised the question then, how do we do that? How do we begin to develop native apps in a way that makes sense, that's not going to kill us? Right? Because it's complicated. It's not the easiest thing to do. And that's the problem many of us struggle with, is that, well, we go with the neutral because that's the easier way to do it, right? Because it fits the skill sets we already have. And that's largely true. But, you know, we have these new technologies coming out now, like Titanium from AppCelerator or PhoneGap, these kinds of technologies, right? That we're starting to get into the kind of cross-platform nature of these tools. And so we went down that road. So we started using Titanium. We had a number of experiments with PhoneGap. We actually developed full apps, put them into production, put them into the store. And here's what we learned. That idea that you take these two great things and combine them together, right? That seems like such a great idea. If I can capture more than one device at the same time, that just seems like an awesome idea. It so much reminds me of those sci-fi original movies, right? The Sharktopus and Dino Shark. You take two awesome things, you combine them together, and they're doubly awesome. And so we thought, okay, well, that must be true here. And then we found Appleroid, right? Unfortunately, that's not what happens. The idea that it's cross-platform, yes, it's technically true. It's a defensible position to take. But the idea that you're writing once and putting on more than one device, maybe, right? And that's why I'll say maybe. But the real cost in there has come from the fact that you've now made an investment in a platform that is, let's say, proprietary, right? You can't decide, you know what, I'd rather just make an Objective-C app to run on my iPhone instead. You can't take anything you've done and use it. So, and actually, in that time you've taken to learn, you know, one of these frameworks and implement it, you could have taken that same amount of time and actually invested in learning the real platform itself. And that was the mistake we discovered, was that we quickly exceeded the capability of the platform. We were using Titanium for our apps, and we quickly exceeded what it could reasonably do. And the performance got to be just really bad. And there wasn't enough debugging information to really do anything with it. And so that's where it occurred to us that essentially we had burned through that time and the only recourse we had would be start over and learn again. But now we've already come, you know, that period of time. So that was the mistake we made, was to take what we thought, this is the clear, easy win. This is Sharktopus and Dino Shark, right? This is the cool thing we can do. And it didn't really work out for us. And so that's where we went back and we made that investment. Now, for some, they really don't want to make that investment because it seems like, you know, a lot of time and a lot of resource to do that. But the reality is the technology is not going anywhere. Do we really believe that iPhones won't be here 3 years from now? Now, is the mobile web the future of mobile applications on phones? Yes, I believe that 100%. Is it true right now? No. Will it be true in the near future? I don't think so. Right? But it is the future of where it's going. So making that investment now is not a lost investment. The other part of it is, how long do you want it to last? Right? So if you look at it that way. Now, once we go through these technology components, we actually have an app and we get it implemented or get it out there, we get it in the store. Next, we're going through an implementation period. Right? And so much what we see with mobile apps is this idea that it creates this experience kind of like what you see on cable news shows, right? Like on ESPN or CNN, something like that, where we have the news crawler, we got scores, we got a ribbon going down the side, we get all kinds of data, and it's all simultaneous, right? And this is an excellent metaphor for what mobile devices do. They give us additional channels that we didn't have before. They give us choice. We can choose to listen to the person talking to me, or I can communicate with a friend, I can communicate with somebody else who's sitting in the same room with me. I have options, and much the same way that you have when you're watching cable television. So as part of that, we put the technology actually into the classroom, right, and see what happens there. Put it in the hands of our students. And with Hotseat, what it does is it begins to draw out in terms of critical thinking and question asking and ways of brainstorming, right? And we can do this in classes that have very large enrollments. Right, classes of 500 or more kids. We can engage them in discussion. But the same way, and you see the picture in the lower right-hand corner, students who are working in labs can communicate with one another, whereas they don't have to give up the time at you know, certain instances of their lab period to the people around them. They can refer back to that discussion that's going on inside of the lab at the points in their lab procedures that make sense. And you see there's displays hanging from the ceiling. So each one of them has their own view to that back channel that exists inside of the laboratory. So all of these become options. And that's the great part about mobile technology, is that it doesn't prescribe certain pedagogies, right? What it focuses on, what it does is it gives the instructor the field, the stick, and the ball, and it says, what kind of game can you make from this? And that's where where our creative faculty will come up with new ways of doing these things. They will come up with new approaches to doing polling in a tool that was never intended to do polling, right? It goes back to my original point about Jurassic Park. Life finds a way, right? People will use the technology and find a way to make it work. Now, once we put it into the classroom, after a period of use, we have to enter into assessment. Is the technology doing what we want it to do? Now, with mobile technology, it's doubly as important. Why? Because it's kind of the sexy, hot thing. And it has to prove itself, right? And it really hasn't yet. Now, what I love about this, so this picture here, this is a brand of makeup, eye makeup, where they've styled the case to actually look like a phone, right? Which is just kind of blows my mind. So the idea of mobility is so popular that a person who makes eye makeup wants to latch onto that. It says, you know what, I could sell more makeup if I just made it look like a phone. You know, people will be interested. That's why assessment is important with our mobile initiatives. Because of that. Because it has that perception that it's that exciting new thing. Right? It can do new things, but we have to know what it does. Now, one of the key challenges we have is that we have this disaggregation of data. Right? So if we're starting to use open resources, or we're starting to use open technologies, Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, Google Apps, Google Plus, these kinds of things, what we're facing is a disaggregation of our data, right? And our phones have the same thing, disaggregation of data. All of the data that we normally would have used to assess the use of the technology now belongs to somebody else. So how do we need ways, clever ways to recombine this, to create like the key ring. Right? This is my identity as a person at the institution. It may be segmented in different places, but it's still me. Right? So what we need to do in order to assess these technologies is we have to find ways to aggregate them, right? As they face continued disaggregation. So once you have that information, what they did was that we can begin to cut it in new different ways. And we've done this a number of different ways. So one thing is just simply through looking at social presence inside of the classroom. So this is dealing with social presence on our hot seat tool. Whereas we're looking at, hot seat helped me see what other people in the class were thinking. Social presence is a good way to measure kind of student engagement inside of the classroom. And it's, there are surveys out there that you can use, and we use them ourselves. And what's nice is as an IT group, we can execute these ourselves. So we don't necessarily have to bring in a collaborator in terms of executing this research. So in terms of IT, we can get these high-level snapshots, right? And that's what's important to us. This isn't the end story, but it's the first step in getting a story. We can't make perfection the enemy of good, right? And that's what we're looking for here, is we want to make a good first step. And social presence, evaluating social presence, is a good way to do that. Here's another one. It's seeing what other people in class were thinking, improved discussion, right? Gets, again, back to social presence. But the other big thing that we need to do is by collecting that data and making that a real part of using the tool, is that we can begin to match usage of the technology against course outcomes, against learning outcomes. And we can provide the data to the instructors to enable them to do it on their own, to find the things, those elements of learning that were most appropriate to their classes. See, the biggest part of providing mobile technology and providing new types of technology is that since it's new, we can develop the analytic collecting tools from day one. Right? We can do that. We can think that through from the beginning. And so we can begin to make those assessments. And then the other part of it is to simply ask them what they think, or what the students think. They provide really interesting feedback, right? It kept me involved in a class that I probably would have blown off, right? Clear win, right? Clear win. It's not driven by an analytic. We don't know necessarily that student was engaged. We don't necessarily know that student was ultimately retained. But what we do know is the student would have otherwise blown off the class, right? So you can learn a lot just from the anecdotal feedback that they provide. So we always ask. And we also look for them on Twitter. They tweet what they think about it, right? They're interesting inputs. Now, once we kind of go through that assessment period, we land on kind of that last piece. So I said before, every project begins and ends with a story, right? So that first story is just the idea, and the last story is what happened, right? Now, what we do is we focus on, we have our studio, whereas essentially we tell the story of the tool, and we tell the story to our faculty, and we tell the story to anyone else who's interested, right? But what we do is we actually explain it. This is what we were thinking when we did this, right? It wasn't just, here's yet another IT service. You know, it's listed right underneath email on the list of things on our website. No, we actually promote it, and we promote it as an individual tool. And then the bigger part of that is that we want to do is promote our faculty. We want to put them front and center. It's their story that's important to us. And they're the ones that tell the most compelling story. Because, I mean, we made the tool. Of course we think it's cool, right? But what we need are the stories from the people who aren't compelled to use it, or aren't obligated to use it, I should say. So that's why it's so important to tell that story. And that's something that I think historically we've struggled with, is how do we tell a story? How do we tell a good story for something that where something positive is happening? So, like I said, this is the evolution that we went through, right? This took us 2 years to learn these lessons. I'm not saying that it works for you. I'm saying it worked for us. So hopefully there's something in there you can extract. But at the end of the day, this was the idea. How do we kind of break out of what we've always done, right? And all it takes to do that is just a willingness to act. And it doesn't have to be a major initiative. Like I said, institutions turn like cruise ships. The odds that somebody is going to one day come and tap on your shoulder and say, you know what, I want you to go out and spend a whole bunch of money to build something awesome, that day's never going to come, right? So what it takes is actually taking smaller steps, placing small bets, mini bets over time. Some of them are going to win and some of them aren't. You have to be willing to turn off the things that aren't working. And you have to have the assessment to know that they're not working, right? So that's what's most important about it. The other thing I wanted to mention today is part of the technology that we have out there, we would be interested in your help. So we've developed these tools, but we only have, you know, essentially our own experiences to work from. So what we've done is we've pulled together what we call a research exchange program. And if you go to our website at purdue.edu/studio/pilot, you can sign up for an email list. Essentially, the idea is we would like to support institutions or faculty, research faculty, in the use of new classroom technology in exchange for research on that technology. Right? Does that make sense? Because, like I said, we can only do it in the confines of our own campus, and we would like to truly, you know, expand the use of the technology. We would like to learn from other people's experiences as a ways to improve those tools. And so what we're offering is this program where we'll support the use of the technology in exchange for research on its usage. So you can go to the website there, and there's an email list you can sign up for. And I just want to wrap up real quick here. This is a link to our studio website. So I've mentioned a couple of tools today. But if you'd like to learn anything more about our story and about the things that we've worked on and kind of the motivations behind them, you go to purdue.edu/studio and learn about a number of different tools. Thank you very much for your time. Oops. I'm going to hop into hot seat here, see if anybody submitted anything. All right. So we did. We got some good voting. So, how much coffee you've had today? Thank you, Jody. All right. So, okay, here's a good one. So, what is the percentage of buy-in from faculty? That's a good question. And it's very hard to identify, you know, such a certain percentage of faculty. So, in terms of hot seat in the classroom, it's somewhere around 20-25 courses, but they tend to be large enrollment courses, so this semester it's somewhere around 3,000 students. Historically, it's somewhere in the neighborhood of 12 to 15,000 students posting some 80,000 questions and ideas, right? So we can kind of look at them that way. So it gets very difficult for us to identify, you know, very kind of broader percentages, because in reality, it's very small. But the part of it is that it's more than one. Right? It's more than two or three. It becomes the scalable platform so that as people develop new ideas for how to implement it, we can just continue to meet those needs. Right? So we have, for example, next semester we'll be experimenting with supplemental instruction. So students who are engaging in supplemental instruction activities while sitting in class can post or tweet or text message the thing that they're having the most trouble with, and their supplemental instruction facilitator then can collect those ideas and knows what to cover in the next session. Right? See, so we're always coming up with new ways to apply the same set of technologies. What is the percentage buy-in from students? Again, percentage is difficult. Mixable is the only tool I talked about today, which is actually focused at students. So one of the unique things about Mixable is that it doesn't require an instructor to use it. Right? A student can just self-select and say, you know what, I want to use that tool and I want to engage my friends with it. And I want to create a study group and use it there. Now, we've not really done any real meaningful marketing on this as of yet. We've largely used it within the scope of classes. But at the same time, we don't preclude students. So some do. We currently have around 4,000 students using it this semester. In terms of its course implementations, I think the number is close to 20 or so. And if you have any questions, I'm just going to kind of do this, but, you know, there's a microphone. Yeah. Yes. Okay. Yeah, and actually that points out, you know, one of the real challenges with going with these kind of back-channel models as a way to augment a live experience. So we have, and there's a really great example of this. We have a personal finance class. It's about 250 students. And as part of their pilot, when they implemented Hot Seat in their classroom, what they do is they use it for students to ask questions with. Right? And then there's a TA in the classroom, monitors for the questions, kicks them up to the instructor. What happens as a result is that historically, they would get 5 or 6 questions from students, just raising their hands and, you know, I have a question. Well, now what they see is 120 questions per class period. How do you begin to do, you know, how do you begin to extract meaning from that? How do you begin to create, find what's relevant in a stream of 120 during a limited fixed period of time for a person who's already got a job, right? They're already teaching. And so we've actually had, we've had faculty engage in this question, dealing with identifying question relevancy in real time. And that's a part of assessment that I didn't really talk about. But one of the greatest wins you can have is if you can make your technology a part of your faculty's research agenda. Right? And that's what we have, is we had an instructor who was an expert in data mining. And he wanted to know, can I find relevancy in this? And he did. Turns out you can develop an algorithm to identify relevancy within a string of questions. And so he published research on that topic. Now, our challenge is, how do we operationalize that research? And it gets at, you know, how do we manage that back channel in real time? Other questions we have out there? Yes, sir, in the back. Good question. Sure. Yeah, and so especially in larger enrollment classes, right? And that's where, by having actually a collection of different possibilities, so that's where they don't all have to have a Wi-Fi connection if a certain percentage of them are on their, you know, smartphones using 3G, or they're just text messaging in. But it is it can be a problem. If we were running, let's say, all laptops in a classroom of 550, that may be a challenge for us. And I guess more to the question, have we run into issues using wireless in these classes? Yes, we have. Other questions? No? All right. Well, like I said, thank you very much for your time. And if you have more questions, please let me know.